So we're going to be looking at those last two chapters of the book of Esther this evening, chapters 9 and 10. And I'll just read verse 1 of chapter 9 to sort of launch us into this. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out. That's the first command and edict, of course, the one that Haman had written, which can't be changed. Of course, they've written a second command, which will help maybe to alleviate it after the demise of Haman. So this is building up the tension. So it's the first one, when they're about to be destroyed. On that very day, when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. So we get to the end of the story of Esther this evening. I don't know whether you've enjoyed it, whether you've found it helpful. It's not been a book I've ever preached on before, but it's been a challenge. But lots and lots of insights into God's workings. But of course, it's this book in which God is so silent. The book in which God simply isn't mentioned. He doesn't speak. And you get to the end of the story and you think, now surely this is when God is going to stand up and come out from behind the scenes and do some great big God things and shake the world as he saves his people. But no, he remains eloquently silent right to the very end. But now we're in that lovely position where we can look right back through the book. And we can see how he has been working. And we can detect his fingerprints on every single chapter in so many circumstances. It was when we read it through the first time. Imagine you'd not read it through before. Or go back to when you did read it for the very first time. And there was a king who got drunk. One bottle of Chardonnay too many in the feast. And ends up having a blazing row with his wife. And none of you, when you read that the first time, thought, ha-ha, there's God at work. You just thought, what a bore that man must have been. And yet, that opened up the opportunity for a new queen to come to the throne. And then when you read about the Persia idol competition, the Persia's Got Talent, the beauty contest, you thought, oh, this is so demeaning. You didn't think, oh, that's how God's going to work, isn't it? And yet it was through that competition that a young Jewish orphan was suddenly rocketed into the palace and becomes the queen of the whole of Persia. And then a great deed was done by a Jewish civil servant, Mordecai, and it was forgotten about. And you thought, ah, it's God not looking. Not working. He should have honoured Mordecai. And instead, this horrible anti-Semite Haman becomes prime minister. And he rises to power. And you were thinking, God, you missed the moment. And then this man gets worse and worse. And because he can't stand the fact that Mordecai won't give him honour, he decides not only to destroy Mordecai, the Jew, but also the whole Jewish race. And we think God's left it too late. But of course God hasn't, because a king has a sleepless night. Because he hasn't got his iPhone and lots of games of Angry Birds, he gets one of his courtiers to come in and to read the annals of the kings of Persia to hopefully send him to sleep. And they read of the event that Mordecai had done, which had saved the king. And suddenly the tables are all turned. And you see, oh, God is working. And the one who wanted to bring Mordecai down is the one who then has to honour him. And then the plot comes out during the queen's feast. And Haman now is facing a crisis. And he throws himself onto Queen Esther to beg for mercy just at the very moment the king walks back in. Awkward. And the king immediately assumes that he's molesting his queen. And with fury hangs Haman on the gallows that he's placed there for Mordecai. And now Mordecai is able to write another decree to counter Haman's decree that, of course, can't be overturned because kings in ancient Persia were not allowed to admit they'd made a mistake and back down. And now the final act of the story comes about, and it is the great reversal. It isn't the people of God who get wiped out, the Old Testament church. It's the enemies of the people of God. An old English Puritan, John Flavel, he wrote a wonderful book on providence, and it's full of great quotes on providence. And one of them, he says, is that the providences of God are like Hebrew words. You have to read them backwards. And you start that side and read that way, for you looking when you're reading Hebrew. You can only read God's providence properly backwards. And that's so true when we're going through our days. We find things don't make sense. Not as we're going forwards through them. And we sometimes shout out, Lord, where are you? Why are you so quiet? Why are you silent? Why aren't you listening to me? Why aren't you working? But when we look back over a long period, over a decade, over a year maybe, we see that God in his silence had been ceaselessly active. Just look back over your own life. There were those coincidences and those happenings. There were the flawed decisions that we made, wrong decisions that we took. And yet somehow God steered an amazing course through all of that and told his wonderful story. I was just thinking about how, I'll be personal for a moment, about how we ended up coming to Netley. And looking at all of the incidents that took place to bring that about. It was a Monday evening, and I had the worst officers' meeting ever. And it had come at the end of a long period of pretty tough stuff in my life. And I'd walked away from that thinking, I can't do this anymore. And Naomi had prayed that evening, Lord, please, just if you want us to be somewhere else, can you possibly just open up a window for us? And of course, God had already answered the prayer, because 67 miles down the A36 in Brownlow Avenue, John was having to fill the pulpit for Netley because they hadn't got a pastor. And he'd gone through all the decent pastors. And Janice had suggested, you could try Paul Oliver up in Bradford. And that very next day, the first time I saw J.H.H. Singleton on an email, flashed into my inbox. But of course, the only date that John had was the graveyard shift, the one right in the middle of the summer holidays, when all of us preachers go away just at the same time to make things difficult for church secretaries. So there's no way that I'd be able to come. And normally we'd be in North Devon on our holidays, but that year we couldn't be in North Devon. And we'd ended up by putting a pin in the back of the Evangelical Times and finding a little house in Poole. Never been to Poole before. It's a lovely place. I've not been back there since, but it's a great place. But we happened on that Sunday, that holiday Sunday, to be in Poole. And I looked at the map, and it's only about that far from Southampton. I didn't realise that that far with the M27 is a very long time. But it looked close enough, and so we said, yeah, we can come on that Sunday. And I remember preaching that first Sunday, standing over there. The church was in a different direction then. And about 10 minutes in, I thought, this is not working at all. I'm going to make an excuse and go home at lunchtime. It was on Balaam's donkey. You can find it on the annals of the church history and website of Netley Christian Fellowship. And I ended up just having to shout at the congregation. I didn't know. They just looked so angry at me. And something happened. Netley woke up. And we, or maybe it was me. And we had a wonderful Sunday. And then at lunchtime, John said, you'd never be thinking of leaving Bradford. And I meant to say no, but it came out as maybe. And events just transpired. And I thought, well, it'll be okay because Netley will never, ever ask me, like with a majority, to come and be their pastor. And then miracles. Netley agreed unanimously. And then we were told we'd never sell our house in Trowbridge. I mean, who wants to live in Trowbridge? Sorry if you come from Trowbridge. But we did. But it never even got to the market. The neighbour snapped it up before we could even get it onto the market. And then schooling fell into place down here. and a house fell into place here. And I just look back through it all and I think, God, you're an amazing God. You never wrote in the stars, go south, young man, or middle-aged man. But with so many little things coming together, God had spoken so wonderfully. And through my flawed decisions and my failures, and through the providences of our lives, he had written our story. When I got here, I thought, if I could do 5 years, that would be amazing. And here I am, 9.5 years later. Maybe we'll get to 10. But it's the same with Esther, isn't it? But in a greater and a more glorious way. But then I was thinking, is it greater and more glorious? Is it more wonderful that the God who works on the macro, international scale and turns emperors and kings and kingdoms where he wants to go, isn't it just as wonderful that he works on the local level and the individual level and the family level and the church level? Because he's just as concerned about you. Because you're so precious to him. I think that's just as wonderful. But here in this great book of Esther, he's just laying out his sovereignty for us. This is how God is in control, even when he's not shouting about it. And silently, yet skillfully and irresistibly, he works through the chaos and the confusion of this world in the lives of people who, at best, Esther and Mordecai are compromised and flawed characters. And at worst, Haman and Xerxes are despotic, evil, anti-everything that God is doing. And it doesn't stop God telling his story, does it? He will tell his story. And he draws together strands that go back way before the times of Esther and Mordecai and Xerxes and Haman. And it's through following those themes back to the times that God has spoken clearly and made his promises and his covenants and his warnings that enables us to read Esther's story as an integral part of God's story. And it's about a great reversal, isn't it? That's our text. When the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. And I was thinking, if I did a series on the whole Bible, I'd call it The Great Reversal. Because that's what God is doing in this world. It takes us right back to the very beginning when God created the heavens and the earth, and it was beautiful, and it was good, and it was good, and then it was very good. And then that beautiful creation is destroyed through Satan's temptation of Adam and Eve. And man and woman who he'd made to know him and to walk with him and to enjoy him and have fellowship with him end up lost and the enemies of God. That's the word which is used, at enmity with God, at war with God. But God, the first time he preaches the gospel in Genesis 3, announcing it to Satan, promises a great reversal. I'll turn this round. I will reverse things so that no longer will there be enmity between me and the people that I love, but instead there will be enmity between the woman, the church, and the serpent, the world, and their families. And one will rise from the woman's family, a mighty saviour, who will utterly destroy the works of the devil and the devil himself. And that conflict between his redeemed family and a God-hated world rages on. We've noticed this. I'll say it for people who are coming in later on in the series. But in a book which is very light on biblical references, hasn't really got any of them, you have to detect some of those details and pull them out. And it's in the genealogies. It's telling us about this ongoing conflict. Haman was an Agagite, is a descendant of King Agag, the king of Amalek. Mordecai was a descendant of a man called Kish, who happened to be the first king of Israel, the father of the first king of Israel, Saul. And we go back another step, and the time when Israel just come out of Egypt and gone through the wilderness, and they were nearing the promised land. The nation of Amalek had attacked Israel and tried to wipe out the covenant-carrying people. They were the first nation to attack the newly formed nation of Israel. And later on, it had been Saul's job to destroy King Agag and the Amalekites. And he was to take, what was it, none of the plunder? Yeah, little cogs whirring for chapter 9 now, aren't they? And he didn't do that. He took some of the plunder and he spared Agag's life. And many Amalekites escaped. And suddenly this terrible conflict has broken out again. Haman, an Amalekite, hundreds of years later, has issued this decree with the king's authority that all the Jews are going to be killed on the 13th day of the month of Adar. And even though Haman's been hoist with his own petard, still this day of destruction is looming. Still Satan is attacking the church, is what I'm trying to say. He's been doing it all the way through up to this point. God had promised that he would build his church at the very beginning, and Satan had promised he'd throw everything at that promise in order to destroy it. So his plan is the eradication of the Old Testament church and the covenant that they're carrying forwards to be unleashed into the world at Pentecost, and the day dawns. We just read the lovely words, the reverse occurred. Everything that he'd planned got turned on its head. Now, maybe the story as I read it to you this evening didn't sit quite so comfortably with a 21st century mind. You were thinking, is the death of 75,800 people something that should be celebrated? Doesn't chapter 9 sound more like genocide to you? Were you thinking, I reckon that Mordecai and Esther should have been dragged off to The Hague to face a war crimes trial? Well, let me remind you from chapter 8 that Mordecai's decree had only allowed the Jews to defend themselves against those who attacked them. So this wasn't like the purge, when you could go out and attack anybody that you wanted. That person who borrowed your lawnmower and hadn't given it back. That person who just kept parking in your parking space. That person who looked a little bit suspicious to you. You couldn't just go out and attack anyone. It was those who attacked them. And what I find is most alarming is that 75,800 people thought it was okay on that day to go out and try to destroy the Jews on the basis of Haman's edict. It's astonishing that there was that level of hatred toward these people and contempt for them. But the reverse occurred. But unlike many of the other Old Testament deliverances, it wasn't through some miraculous divine intervention. It wasn't through a great hailstorm or through fire and brimstone falling. It was through a political act. God works through politics. And the Jews, and then many citizens of the empire, all got together to defend themselves, to defend the Jews. But there's a big clue. I've hinted it already, that points to the fact that the Jews saw the hand of God in this. And God had given Agag into Saul's hand and promised that he would have victory over him. He had said, "You shall take no plunder." It was God's war. It was God's judgment on his enemies. Three times over, verse 10, 15, and 16. What did you read? And they took no plunder. And what is surprising is that Mordecai's counter decree allowed them to take plunder. They could have got very rich off of this. But he keeps underlining this. They didn't take any plunder. They were thinking back to Saul and Agag. They saw this as the finishing off of God's unfinished judgment on those who had hated them and who still hated them and desired their destruction. This was God's war. And ultimately, I guess there are two options for people. This is something that just leaps out of the text. You can join his family and be safe, as many people did at the end of chapter 8, as the gospel tells you to do everywhere. Come, says God, be part of my family, be saved. Or you can go on fighting against God and his people. And it's a futile fight, because whatever plans you come up with, the reverse occurs. There's not a middle ground. You can't be like Switzerland, forever ducking out of every single war that goes on. We're all in one camp or the other. There are only two families in Genesis 3, God's and the world's. And I want us to be in God's. I trust and I pray that we are. But there's another issue, a bit of a complex one, isn't there, in this? Did Esther go too far? When the king, having seen the, in inverted commas, success of the first day of defending themselves and then attacking their enemies, did she go a bit far in asking for a second day of slaughter on her enemies? I won't say discuss. You could probably make a case either way. One of the commentators says this: Esther's request is another instance of the disquieting moral ambiguity that characterizes the story. You're never told whether their decisions were made in good ways or bad, or not often. There is a disquieting moral ambiguity that characterizes the story. And rather than attempting to resolve it, we should just reflect on it. Whether or not Esther was justified in extending the killing a second day, the perennial failure of Israel's greatest leaders to war against moral and spiritual darkness without engaging in sin themselves suggests that there is nobody in the Old Testament who is worthy to wage true, holy war in God's name. God's strategy against sin and evil was awaiting a perfect warrior who could execute divine justice with clean hands and a pure heart. And his name is Jesus. And he's the one that the greatest reversal of all is dependent upon. Because when the one who is able to judge all the enemies of God with clean hands and a clean heart and absolute justice came, first of all, he gave his own life for his enemies so that justice and mercy could meet. And it casts our minds forward to that time that Satan thought he'd finally done it, when a plot worse than Haman's had been hatched. Jesus himself called it the hour of the power of darkness. From the day before the cross, that's how Jesus described what was happening. This was the day when darkness was at its darkness. It was the day when everything evil seemed to have triumphed, and the Messiah stood rejected by the people that he'd come to save. And the one who would judge the world was absolutely condemned himself. The one who said he'd crush Satan's head was cast down to the lowest point in the universe and nailed to a cross of curse. The beloved son was forsaken by his own father. The giver of life bowed his head and died, and the light of the world was extinguished. Satan must have rejoiced as finally he thought he'd destroyed all the plans of God, as the son died. But what's our text? The reverse occurred. Be happy and glad. God had it all under control. This wasn't the end of the hopes of the world, but the fulfillment of them. Christ had died for our sins. Satan had been left silent. Death had been destroyed by the man it couldn't hold. The resurrection had been guaranteed. Eden had been assured of its rescue and redemption and restoration. the reverse had occurred. The curse had been overturned, and God reverses the outcomes Satan had plotted and planned. And the same thing happens through history. We've got to remember that when we're watching the news. Jesus has said, I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell are not going to prevail against her. And every time something rises up and says, we will prevail, we will push the church out of this land, we will crush the church, in heaven they just say, and the reverse occurred, because it always does. And the church grows and grows. And then God reverses the emotions that his people go through. Verse 22, sorrow is turned into gladness and mourning into a feast. And that's what happens, isn't it, when a death sentence is lifted? You don't think, oh no, we're safe. Oh, isn't that terrible? So exciting living under the death sentence. And when it's lifted, you're happy, you're glad. And how much more for the Christian? As an eternal death sentence has been lifted by the great reversal of the cross, God has turned everything round. Let's hold that in abeyance for a moment and just quickly deal with the rest of the chapter. My first point, I've only got two, and the second one's really short. I haven't got a clock. I don't know how long I've been speaking for. I'm sorry about this morning. You really need to get that clock fixed. But the first point was reversal. The second is remembrance, isn't it? Because the rest of the chapter, the rest of the book is about how this feast of Purim entered the Jewish calendar alongside the three Old Testament feasts that God had given them. The feast of, I should test you now, Passover, the feast of Pentecost, or weeks, you might call it, and the Feast of Booths, when you went and camped on top of your house. They were the three feasts that God had given, and the Jews here add this feast to their calendar. They'd add another one a bit later, after another spectacular deliverance, when Antiochus Epiphanes, that Syrian Greek king, tried to wipe out the Jews, and they added the Feast of Hanukkah. And it was not to be forgotten, this Feast of Purim. Why not? This is a great deliverance from God. I guess Jesus would have celebrated Purim 500 years later and hit with his family. Some people think that the Feast of John 5, which is an unnamed feast, might well have been the Feast of Purim. And they're still celebrating it today, about a month before our Easter. So I thought what I ought to do is I ought to go and visit the Feast of Purim, which of course you can do online really now, can't you? With a few YouTube videos, I was able to see what happened at Purim. And the Jews get together and they read the story of Esther, and all the little children, they boo every time that Haman is mentioned. And they're given these little, do you remember the 1950s and the rattles they used to have at football matches? Well, you don't remember them, but you've probably seen, some of you do, you've probably seen the pictures of them. Yeah. And every time Haman gets mentioned, they and every time Mordecai gets mentioned, there's a great big cheer goes up. And they have their equivalent of the nativity play, but it's the Purim play. And the little children, the lucky one becomes Esther. And the unlucky kid, it would have been me, ends up as being Haman. And the very lucky one ends up as being Mordecai. And they give gifts of food to each other. There's a speciality. It's a little triangular biscuit, which is called Haman's ears. And they pass these things around. And it is so joyful. I was so thrilled as I was watching this. I was really drawn into it. It was a time of feasting. It's a time of celebration, of remembering great deliverance. And then as I watched it, my heart just broke. Because isn't there something better than just having Purim as the height of your celebrations? As they finish their great story and get to the end of it, verse 10 of chapter 10, in chapter 10, Mordecai was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people. He spoke peace to them. I just longed for those families to know the greatest reversal of all and the greatest deliverance, that there is one so much greater than Mordecai. Wasn't the promise to their father Abraham that one of his seed, one from their nation, would not just seek the welfare of his people, but be a blessing to all the nations of the earth, to Jew and Gentile alike? Paul, a Jew, we read it last week, could say, I have sorrow of heart for my brothers and sisters to whom were given the promises. My heart breaks for them. I want them to know that the promises are theirs, and yet so many at the moment can't see. I long for a world in which more Jews and Gentiles come together to the foot of a cross that said, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Romans 11 says, now if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion be? We're incomplete without the Jews being added to the church. And we should long for greater and greater numbers. I long for days when the little children in those families will not just shout for Mordecai, a great Old Testament hero. I hope they carry on doing Purim, it's great. But they'll shout louder for Jesus, the blesser of all the nations. And Jews and Gentiles, in greater number, in greater joy, sit down together, not at the Feast of Purim, but the feast at the supper that we're going to celebrate in a few moments points to. The great feast of the end of time. Well, it's the gospel of Jesus that brings us together. And it's the gospel of Jesus that fully turns sorrow into gladness and mourning into feasting. You pray for the Jews. Pray for Christian Witness to Israel, visited us a few weeks ago. They're much in the news at the moment. And there's so much about anti-Semitism at the moment. But the book of Esther encourages us that all these leaders and these big, powerful movers and shakers end up bringing about God's plan of a great reversal, of a curse turned into blessing, of enemies becoming a family made up of Jews and Gentiles, his family, the church.